You'll notice that you have two papers in front of you. And I have violated my own rule, which is to always only use one paper. But first, I figured the fact that it was in English makes it a little quicker of a read. But second, because there are two separate tshuvas. The first paper you have is a tshuva about burying a potential convert, a possible convert. The second tshuva is about something much more contentious, which we'll talk about a little bit more than the first one, which is Rabbi Eloi's statement and ultimatum to the circumcisers in town that they are not allowed to circumcise children that come from non-Jewish mothers. And we'll get into the nitty-gritty soon. And just a little bit about Rabbi Eloi for a second. Fascinating person. Rabbi Eloi was born in Bohemia in 1814 and studied with the Chassam Sofer, you know, the Rav Moshe Sofer that everybody knows and loves. So the Chassam Sofer's, I've read that the Chassam Sofer's only student to ever get a PhD was Rabbi Bernard Eloi. He goes to the University of Budapest and gets a PhD. He spoke, I think, seven languages. I wrote it down somewhere. Latin, Greek, Hebrew, German, French, and Italian. Only six. I don't understand the politics so well in Bohemia in the 1830s or 40s, but apparently he was on the wrong side of politics, and he was opposed to the Habsburg Empire, and because of that, he actually had to flee to the United States. That's how he ends up in America. In the early 1850s, he has pulpits early on in New York City, and in Syracuse, and in Philadelphia, and in Baltimore, and St. Louis. And he makes his way, once he gets to St. Louis, he basically stays in what we would call the Midwest. He ends up in place in St. Louis, in New Orleans, and in Cincinnati. You'll notice that our first responsa is from Nashville, Tennessee, which is nowhere where he was. But because of his prominence in the Midwest of America, so he actually garners some attention from the surrounding cities, which at the time had, you know, no rabbis, as we talked about last week. Even though in the 1800s there were considerable Jewish communities across the United States, there were not many rabbis, either because of lack of interest from the people, or because of lack of money, or because of lack of interest from the rabbis to leave Europe. So you only had a handful of Orthodox, worthwhile, trustworthy Orthodox rabbis that came over from Europe with a bona fide education. And one of them was Rabbi Yisachar Dov Bernard Eloi, student of the Chassam Sofer. This is obviously a picture of him. And you can see his prominence, but I don't know if this is necessarily any different than a regular person would look in the 1860s. But if you see very closely, there's something very interesting about this picture. Besides his hat, and his bow tie, does anyone see something very, very nuanced, very small? Well, he's got a cane. He has a cane, but that's not so nuanced. His right ring finger has a ring on it. He is one of the very few rabbis that we know of who is a student of the Chassam Sofer that wore a wedding ring. Obviously, the Chassam Sofer did not wear a wedding ring, and he did not promote wearing a wedding ring. But it is a very interesting nuance to notice in that picture that he is wearing a wedding ring, and I've seen people talk about it. It's kind of interesting to see that. In a portrait like this. There are other pictures of him, yeah.
Right hand?
It's on his right hand, yeah.
It's on the left hand?
No, this is his right hand. It's on the left side of the picture, but it's his right hand. What did you say, Michael? I don't actually know. I tried to figure it out. It seems like it might have been in language or something like that. He did teach secular studies before he left Bohemia, or before he left Europe. I think it was in Germany. He taught secular studies at a gymnasium. I don't know why they were teaching in a gym, but no, I'm kidding. The following situation occurs in Nashville. A little bit of the background of Nashville, Tennessee. Organized Jewish religious life in Nashville didn't begin until 1848. Small group of Jews met together to pray at the home of a man named Isaac Gerritsen. Keep that name in mind. There's some papers in the back, Rabbi Belsky, if you want. This small minion eventually grew into a full-fledged Jewish congregation. 3 years later, Nashville Jews formed the Hebrew Benevolent Burial Society Association and purchased land for a cemetery. By 1853, the group had hired Rabbi Alexander, anyone want to guess how to pronounce that? Isser? If it was Isser, that would be a very interesting combination of Alexander and Isser. But either way, that's his name. Alexander Isser, who was paid $600 a year. $600 a year, I guess I shouldn't complain as much. In 1854, they officially incorporated as Kal Kodesh Magen David in honor of Davidson County. They call themselves based on their secular community. I'm not reading any sheets that you have, by the way. Despite their new official name and spiritual leader, the congregation continued to meet in the home of Gerritsen until they rented a room in North Market Street in 1857. When Isser left his vision to go into business, the congregation advertised for a Jewish jack of all trades, someone who could be a chazan, a Hebrew teacher, a shochet, a mohel, all for only $600. In 1857, they hired Emmanuel Marinson, who encouraged the congregation to build a mikvah. 2 years later, he was replaced by Jonas Heilbon, who started a religious school that taught Hebrew to the young boys of the congregation. The small congregation, however, was very contentious. Members struggled to adjust their traditional beliefs and practices to a new environment. When Isaac Gerritsen's wife died in 1856, there was a dispute over whether she should be buried in the Jewish cemetery. And that's where we're left off here. So this is only 8 years after really the Jewish community has started. There's not much in Nashville, Tennessee. And this becomes a contentious issue because it's basically the host of the congregation, right? The guy who hosts the minyanim, his wife just died. The question, however, is what's this guy and specifically his wife's background? So that's where we get into this tshuva on the first page here. It should be noted that many of, or a bunch of Rabbi Eloi's tshuvas or responses were written in English. He did have some, a bunch that were written in Hebrew. And the Hebrew ones look like a regular tshuva that you'd find somewhere else. They have, regular, sources and arguments back and forth. In English, you don't see it as much because he's obviously catering to his audience. So you'll notice he references certain sources, but he doesn't go into the same depth that he does in the Hebrew ones. They're all actually, the English and the Hebrew ones, written up in his son's sefer called Milchamos Elohim, the Wars of God. And you can actually find many of them translated online. And many of them were also printed in a newspaper which was started by Isaac Leeser in the 40s named The Occident. People heard of The Occident before. It was around for probably half a century, if I'm not mistaken. It started in the 40s by Isaac Leeser, another, at least for the time being, Orthodox rabbi. There's much debate as to what happens to him later in his life. But Isaac Leeser starts this newspaper, and it's really like a periodic. It's a monthly magazine, and he gathers up information from across the United States about what's going on in each community. Very exciting times. Jewish communities being built, rabbis joining communities, people coming over from Europe, and he keeps track of all of it and sends out this monthly magazine to keep people in the know. And one of the things that he does is he oftentimes brings in very relevant tshuvas, very relevant halachic topics that people maybe are struggling with across the country. We'll see in a second what happens in New Orleans about the circumcisions, but it should be noted that New Orleans was way past this tshuva. This tshuva was, water under the bridge. They had, for a long time, already been burying non-Jewish women in their Jewish cemetery. To keep that in mind. Here in Nashville, it seems like they hadn't yet crossed that bridge. So when it comes to Rabbi Eloi's authority on the issue, you'll see here, at a meeting of the congregation Kilas Kadosh, Magen David of Nashville, March 23rd, 1856. On motion, it was resolved that that the Reverend Dr. Eloi be invited to attend this meeting to give his opinion in the case of the burial of Mrs. Sarah Gerritsen. Carried unanimously after hearing his views at length on the subject, it was resolved that the meeting abides by his decision, carried unanimously. Right? So he's a rabbi being brought in to decide this case. You can see how they wrote their minutes in the shul board meetings. He was brought in to decide, and they all agreed with him. I don't know how big the board was. I presume that it wasn't very big because the shul wasn't that big. But either way, this is what Rabbi Eloi says. a very interesting background, and one which I think might be prototypical of many families that were living in America at the time. So keep that in mind. This day came before me a question concerning a deceased person whose right to burial some have contested. And I decide according to the knowledge with which the Lord has favored me, but that all men might know the justice of the case, I will explain all which belongs to the inquiry and the answer which I have given thereto. This is happens to be a point of contention for modern rabbis. Do you give the reasons for your answers? Now, in tshuva books, that's fine. You know, you write a sefer of tshuvos, people who's going to read the sefer, they'll know what you're talking about. But for the layman, who don't really know the sources that well, or don't really have the commitment to really devote themselves to the sources as well as the rabbis might, it's a very interesting case to actually give over in English all of the facets of your argument to an unlearned population, one which could engender a lot of controversy and a lot of discussion. Either way, that's what Rabbi Lowy decides to do. I know rabbis even today that when they give a psak, they don't give their reasons. Because it's not for you to decide. I have the reasons, you have to trust me. I'm not going to sit here going through back and forth with the sources with you. Personally, it depends on the situation and the question. But Rabbi Elohi's position here was to tell everybody what's going on. A certain Jew, a native of Holland, whom it is not necessary to mention my name. We know his name. His name was Isaac Gerritsen. But it's not necessary to mention my name. Took unto himself a Gentile wife. Right? This is Sarah Gerritsen. And left his own country with her to seek a home in another portion of the world, to wit, some part of America, and it came to pass that he had lived with her in a manner contrary to our law for some years, meaning she wasn't Jewish. His spirit disturbed him for the wrong he had done, and he moved his heart, the heart of his wife, after the God of Israel, to forsake the false belief of a strange God and not to confide any more in a mortal son of man. She wants to convert. And she also said for her part, Moses is true and his law is true, therefore I'll go with the join the Lord, thy people shall be my people, thy God by my God. I will call in the name of God of Israel, and in his ways, statutes and commandments will I walk all my days, and in this faith I will live and die. Obviously some pieces in there that you might be familiar with. And so it happened that in the year 5599, or 1839, this man returned with his wife to Holland, the land of his birth, and they came together to the city of Amsterdam. The man took his wife and brought her before the judges of Israel, the chief teachers, and besought them to make a proselyte of his wife and to induct her into the covenant which the Lord made with Horeb, with the children of the women, even those of Jeshurun. Right, so she's going to convert. But these men replied, here's the problem in Holland at the time. These men replied that they could not do so in their city, as a royal ordinance had interdicted any one of that one from quitting his native religion. You have to stick with your religion. No one should dare to convert to Israelite to become a Christian, or a Christian to become an Israelite. But as they saw perplexity of both the man and the woman, for it was great, they said, we cannot afford to transgress the king's ordinance, but do this, go to a small and little populated city where the thing can be quietly and noiselessly done. So in Holland, they say, we can't take care of you here. I don't know why they had a base in for Garris if they couldn't do any Garris, but they brought him in front of them, and they said, sorry, we can't do it. Okay? The man did so, and they went with his wife to the town of Marche, I don't know, where by permission of the Lord, the judges of the city made his wife a Jewess, and brought her into the covenant of the Lord. Baruch Hashem, she became Jewish, doing unto her all the requirements appertaining to females, all as is written in the book, respecting the laws of proselytes, after which she married her legally, she became a wife, and according to the law of Moses in Israel. But, and this is the fact, this is the operating issue, when he required of the judges a certificate signed with their hand and bearing their seal, that he might have as proof and defense that his wife had been made a Jewess, they refused compliance, fearing that it might become known that you're against the moral mandate. Right? So they did the Gerus. They just have no proof of it. And now, fast forward 20 years, and they're stuck here in Nashville, Tennessee, trying to figure out, can we bury her in a Jewish cemetery? So the people in the community are like, she's not Jewish. And he said, no, she is. We went to Holland, and we had this whole thing, blah, blah, blah. So the question really is, in halachic terms, can we believe the husband that that his wife was actually converted? Because we don't have any other proof. Because they don't want it to be on the books. It's got to be under the table so no one knows that they did such a thing, because it's against the law. Steve?
I'm assuming she lived her life.
Good. Yeah, she lived it Jewishly. And everybody knew that. Everybody knew that. Yeah. What did you say? So we'll get to Rabbi Lowe's answer. I didn't say an answer. We'll get to the answer. Yes, Saul.
Do we have a sense if he did any independent research, or is that based on?
That's an interesting question.
Because if he heard from the rabbis that they did it just unofficially, then it's case closed.
Right. So apparently he doesn't. This is all from the word of the husband's mouth. Yeah, so we don't really know. The question is, do we trust the husband? Yeah, Mike.
Why did he pursue another conversion?
He didn't think he needed it. He didn't think he needed it. You mean, why didn't he go? Where is he going to go? What? In America? They didn't do Geras well in America. Yeah, I don't know. They could have. They didn't. So the question really is, it's a good question, except for the fact that he thought everything was fine. It's only once she died that people made us think about it. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's what he wanted to do. They couldn't do it. Yeah, you're right. You're right. If he knew this was going to happen, he would have made sure to get it. Yeah, Henry.
40 or 50 years ago, when there was a new flux.
Yeah. Immigrants.
People went to be Hebrews or whatever.
Yeah.
They had to show proof.
Yeah, don't. Why are we going 40, 50 years ago? In Israel, this is a big issue.
Yeah.
In Israel, this is a big issue right now, political issue. And they can't really figure out an easy way to do it. Yeah, but. Yeah, sure. Yeah. That's an interesting point. Why didn't they have a ksuba if they got married again? I don't know. That's interesting. Maybe, I don't know, maybe they did and they didn't take it as serious. There are rabble rousers in the community, right? People that want to make sure that their Jewish cemetery has Jewish people in it. They don't want to desanctify anything. So when this question comes up, I don't know if they had a ksuba. I don't know, but if they had a ksuba, I don't know if the ksuba would have been enough. It's hard to say. But let's see how Rabbi Eloi comes up with an answer. After this man returned to his wife, the country of America, it is now nearly 15 years since they settled in the city Nashville, where they had done what is right and good in the eyes of the Lord. She no less than he. Because she was pious, modest, and strict, being more particular than other Jewesses, nothing prohibited ever entered her house. She upheld, kept, and sanctified the Sabbath in the most particular manner. And every day she duly prayed to God, the God of Israel. Her hand she opened to the poor and showed kindness to the living and the dead. And she educated her husband's daughter, by his first wife to the fear of God, and taught her well what the daughters of Israel have to observe, that which is and what is to be done, how to conduct the household according to the word of the King, the Lord, so that her table might always be set before those very particular concerning the food permitted to them. And then she prospered and succeeded, for the daughter emulated the good deeds of the mother. And now, in the past week, on the second day of, I think this might be a mistranslation of some kind, the Adar might be Adar Beis, I don't know. What? That's what you think? Yeah. Towards daybreak, she awoke from her sleep and called her husband and told him she was exceedingly ill. He rose to prepare something to give her relief, but she said to him with the strength and of spirit and resignation, "There is no earthly remedy for me. My end has come. I am failing, and my sight has left me. Therefore, pray with me. May I bless the Lord before I die." The husband thereupon lifted up his voice, and while he wept, he said with her, "Shema Yisrael," and she repeated after him 6 times, word by word, "The Lord is God." And the 7th time she had not quite finished when her spirit fled, and her soul returned to her father's mansion. A really dramatic scene. And when the husband afterwards desired to bury his wife and to perform the necessary religious rites, some persons objected and refused to give him permission to bury his dead in the burying place unless he could bring proof that his wife had been made a Jewish according to law. Nevertheless, permission was granted him to bury his wife among the Jewish dead, and now some men have come before me and asked me as to what was right, whether the objectors or the husband. So she's buried. Right? He was taken care of. By the time the letter got to him and he had to get sent back, she was already buried. Yeah, Jason.
Can you explain what's the problem with marrying an actual?
Yeah, there's a certain sanctity.
Yeah. At a
minimum.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of Kabbalah that goes along with these things that's beyond my forte, but it has to do with maintaining a certain sanctity of that place. There might be other issues of Tchiyas HaMesim that are involved with it also. I don't really know for sure. I don't know personally. Yeah.
Also, the concept of being a Noahide, once you accept the Torah, you could be violating Noach Bah, so it's not so simple.
In some ways, that's true. In some ways, but Noach Bah doesn't help you because you're still not Jewish. Either way, I'm not really sure in terms of the intricacies of that halacha, but it's definitely something we try very hard to maintain. And I answered in this way. They who have shown kindness of truth with the dead, to bury this pious woman, the daughter of Abraham with the children of Abraham, have done well and deserve well for the pious act which they have committed, and the objectors are wrong for many reasons. For, first, we are taught that a father is credible as a witness to testify of his daughter that he had married her to a priest, wherefore she is permitted to eat of the heave offering. Now this is a source. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, it's in Yevamos, maybe. Is it Yevamos, the beginning of Yevamos? Yeah. Talking about the neimanus of someone to say they were coming, based on the fact that their daughter could eat truma. I think it's at the beginning of Yevamos or Ksubis, I don't remember. One of the two. And although he is known to be holy and an Israelite, he is believed. And his daughter may eat of holy things, and he needed to bring no other proof now. Whereas, as respects eating of holy things, which is prohibited by the scriptures to a person, not a priest, a father is to be believed. How much more should a husband be believed to testify of his wife that she had become a proselyte to entitle her to be buried with the dead of Israel? Right, so if a father can testify based on his childhood, if I remember the Gemara correctly, based on his childhood, to say that he was a Kohen, that his daughter can now eat Truma, almost how much more so someone in the present, who just last week was living with his wife and only 15 years ago remembers going to Holland. So obviously he should be believed. Secondly, one witness is credible in all prohibitions contained in Scripture. We have a concept in Halacha, Eid Echad Ne'eman Bisurin, that you only need one witness. Consequently, the inference is that it ought to be more so in matters resting on rabbinical authority. So it's sort of a kol shekein. I'm not really sure how far that concept goes. I know it applies to dinim of arayos, but I'm not sure if this would count as that concept. Yeah.
So the Kohen and his daughter must be some other nuance there as well, because if it was a question on him, then he couldn't be the truma himself, let alone be with his daughter.
Yeah, so there is something interesting there. Yes, Steve. Oh, is that what the situation was? I'm just recalling the Gemara, but the father's credible as a witness testified that of his daughter that he had married her to a priest. Okay, yeah, that could be. Yeah, that's a different situation than I'm thinking of. It might still be in the same Gemara, but I don't remember it. So yeah, somehow he has the ability to prove or to be believed that his son-in-law was a Kohen. That she was married to him, yeah. But, I don't know. I don't know what the situation is, that the son's not around or something. Either way, one witness is believed. Thirdly, this woman proved by her whole course she had become a proselyte at her end. When she departed in the knowledge of the Lord of God as God, demonstrates that the inference from her previous life is just. Meaning, she lived the life of a Jew, right? Everything she did was Jewish. So we can believe, based on that, there's strong evidence that she was actually Jewish. Everyone who observes the precepts which are obligatory on Israel has an evident claim to be regarded as an Israelite, and he that objects is bound to bring his proofs, right? She doesn't have to prove herself. Everybody else has to disprove her. Right, innocent until proven guilty, although obviously in this situation it's a little bit different based on the fact that we have testimony that he was back in Europe and he had done stuff there. We rely on the presumptive proof to permit the wife of a lost person to marry again and to eat of holy things, thus raising an Israelite to the rank of a priest. Why shall we not then rely in this instance on presumptive proof so as not to take this pious woman out of her grave and to insult her after death? This is basically saying, well, we already did it, and we shouldn't, you know, even for a possibility, take her out. For can there be a greater presumptive proof than her having lived and died as a real Israelitess? Israelitess? Doesn't sound like a nice word, but wherefore, we decide according to the presumptive evidence. See, the beginning of the Nedarim, and the Rashi, and the Rashba, and all casuists, on the passage, and the Tosfot to the section, the woman that has become a widow. Rif and Rambam in connection with the Ksubis. Oh, maybe it's that the Gemara of the Ksubis. Chav Beis and Chav Vav. So he clearly he shows you the sources, but he's not going through like a regular tshuva. I therefore maintain again that the husband need to bring no proof, but the objectors ought to do it. And of the soul of the deceased, let us say, the memory of the righteous be blessed, and her soul be bound up in the bound of life with the souls of pious men and women. So, pretty straightforward, to the point, Rabbi Elohi says, stop hakin her chinuk. She's Jewish. She's Jewish. We have plenty of reasons to think that she's Jewish, and no one should make any stink about it anymore.
And if they have children with this also, then...
Presumably. I would think so. They're a little older, it seems. Yeah.
Is there an issue also of if they had to disinter her covered mace for...
That seems like he included that in the fifth point there. That's what it sounds like. But he didn't really need that based on his first 4 points. But yeah, that would be an added issue, presumably. But again, if it was true, like if we didn't have the first 4 points and it was true that she was not Jewish, so then Kavod HaMeis applies to everybody else in the cemetery, right? That they're now being buried with a non-Jew, right? So I once heard this early on in my rabbinic experience. I think it was in Riverdale, where people, you know, it's always very difficult if people have non-Jewish relatives that they want buried next to them or with them or something like that. And, you know, they may covered a mace, you know, they should be buried properly, there's a family, whatever. So the rabbi said back, like, covered a mace is true, but I have covered a mace. Everybody else in the cemetery has been entrusting me to maintain the sanctity of this entire place. So just because covered a mace for one person doesn't necessarily mean I can override the covered a mace for everybody else. So it's definitely a tricky situation. So that's situation number one, Nashville, Tennessee. He was not yet in New Orleans at that time. But what you see from this tshuva is very interestingly that there were some people in America that were very committed to Judaism and Orthodox Judaism, so much so that they're willing to make such a contention about a person whose wife lived Jewishly for all they knew and then only figured out later that maybe we should make us think about it. But obviously it's misguided in their piety, because Rabbi Elohi basically puts them in their place. Did you want something?
I was going to say that it sounds weird to call that piety. When all the evidence...
Right, that's what Rabbi Elohi is telling.
One of them was super pious, and these people were
right.
Who knows about that?
Yeah, no, it's true. But what's interesting about it, and the reason I say it in those words, is because in other places in Jewish cities, they were willy-nilly burying non-Jewish people in their cemeteries. At least in this cemetery, they were caring about it. Unfortunately, it was misguided in their concerns. But it's something that other places weren't even thinking about. Right, and they wanted to make sure that they were converted. But you're right, that's what Rabbi Elohi says. What are you guys talking about? The guy has a solid story, and you're bothering them for no reason, which is a problem, yeah.
So the result of the case that he had to determine this one would seem that anything less would not be accepted.
No, not necessarily. He's not saying this is the benchmark. There could be less. He gave five reasons. Let's say you had one of those reasons. That's less,
right,
but it still could be good enough. Yeah, so that would be more of an issue. That would be more of a question. This doesn't necessarily inform on all cases, but it's just an interesting societal. Right. Yeah. Yeah, and as I said before, they had a rabbi. He was the jack of all trades, but he didn't have the shoulders to take on this issue, so they brought to Rabbi Elohi for greater confirmation, and he gives it to them. That is interesting. Yeah, so that's another interesting piece, and it comes up more relevantly in the next tshuva, which is that despite the fact, and this comes up in many Jewish communities across the country, despite the fact that the rabbi is entrusted to give his halachic opinion, he's not always entrusted to enforce his halachic opinion, which comes up in many, many unfortunate situations where you see even Rabbi Elohi is jumping from town to town. Why is he jumping from town to town? Because no one's listening to him. Right? That's why he has to move. As we'll see soon. Jason, yeah. Yeah, it seems pretty, substantial. I don't know the sources as well as Rabbi Elohi does. So I couldn't tell you. There are some Gemaras that sound intriguing to me in terms of how we apply them. But, yeah, it sounds good to me. Yeah. Yeah, that's what you say. Erech Hanami Bisurin. That's what I said earlier. That's definitely a strong halachic concept that we have.
So what do you do these days? If somebody comes from out of town and move in here, and you find out that one of them converted.
Nowadays, it's a lot easier than it was for Rabbi Elohi, because I can call up the Beis Din that they converted by, and I can ask them, you know, make sure that they're a legitimate Beis Din. I could ask other Beis Din that established their credibility. It's much, you know, it's not always an easy process, but it's much easier than it was for Rabbi Elohi. He's not going to call up Holland. You know, it's not.
Is it actually done these days?
Yeah, for sure, all the time. I've done it already since I've been here. Was there something else over here? Okay, let's move on to the next tshuva. So Rabbi Elohi ends up in New Orleans, and in 1864, he's brought to this situation where, first of all, a little bit of history with New Orleans. When Rabbi Elohi gets to New Orleans, I think in the late 1861, I think it was. So they say, his son says in this sefer, Melchamos Elokim, that on, well, first of all, the shul that he joins, which is called Shaarei Chesed, even though in English, some people mix it up, the letters, there's like an N and a G, I don't know how it happened. Shangari? Okay, so maybe that's where it comes from. The Ayin is a G, but what's the N from? Oh, Ung. Okay. Oh, okay. It's the N also. Okay. So that's how some people say it in the literature, Shangarei Chesed, but it's Shaarei Chesed for us Americans. And when the shul was created, there were 13 members that created the shul, 7 of whom were married to non-Jews. And yet they were keeping it as an Orthodox congregation. So that's the situation already in New Orleans. It's an older congregation. It's much older than the Nashville situation. Yeah. I haven't even said anything yet. No, it did. It definitely did. Well, there are different things. In Europe, there definitely was a reform movement. A conservative movement, I'm not sure exactly if it got off the ground yet. But there was definitely reform in Europe, and there was what one would call reform in America. Meaning they didn't necessarily say, we are now an official reform congregation, but there were plenty of congregations that were by de facto reform. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, New Orleans had established itself as, had an established Jewish group. Already back in the early 1700s. And there have been Jews since, you know, for a long time in New Orleans. And through the years, they create their own communities. And people are probably familiar with Judah Toro of the Toro Synagogue in Rhode Island. So he actually sets up shop in New Orleans and builds a big business. It wasn't very kind and philanthropically to the Jews originally, but ends up giving. Some people say that they called the shul Shaarei Chesed in order to encourage him to give some money to the shul. And when he passes away, he actually leaves a lot of money to the shul and to the general communities around the country at the time. He actually fought in the War of New Orleans or something like that. People might be more familiar than I am. But he was a substantial, you know, he was committed to the Jewish community. He also committed to some churches in the area. Good. So that's going to come up. But in 1861, Rabbi Elohi comes to New Orleans. And they say, his son says, that the first sukkahs, there was only one sukkah in town, and it was in the shul. It was by the shul property. But the next year, there were 40 sukkahs in town. So he had already been making very long strides in promoting the Yiddishkeit of the people in New Orleans. Unfortunately, for a number of reasons, one of which is the tshuva we're going to read today, the New Orleans community really takes a hit religiously. And the Civil War is a bigger proponent of that because of the people that transplant into New Orleans afterwards because of the Civil War that are, by and large, much more Reform than they are Orthodox and thereby encourage Rabbi Elohi to resign. The Board of Directors was changing drastically anyway, so Rabbi Elohi saw the writing on the wall and got out of Dodge. But He says here, if you look at the source here, so this is printed in one of the Jewish newspapers, the Jewish Messenger. I'm not really sure of the history of the Jewish Messenger. I know it merged with other Jewish newspapers later on. But we say here, it says here, Rabbi Elohi made this, you know, he made this rule, right? He established the rule in the city. He didn't give a lot of background to it. No one is allowed to circumcise a child of a non-Jewish mother. Okay, that's what he said. Then he said that anyone who does the circumcision of a non-Jewish mother, of a child of a non-Jewish mother, is thereby prohibited from being a circumcision, from doing circumcision anymore. And he says anyone who is doing the circumcision is himself. Any father that allows a circumcision, father which is Jew, who is Jewish, who allows a circumcision is committing a sin. Okay, so in response to that declaration, many rabbis in America and in Europe take on this issue. And you'll notice here that in the Messenger itself, they try to give over their own personal opinion of the matter. We readily endorse the decision of Dr. Elohi, respecting the admission of the sons of non-Israelite women into the covenant of Abraham, right? So they say, we agree with Rabbi Elohi. The authority of a rabbi in this country, being unfortunately limited by his moral influence, Dr. Elohi had no power to enforce his decision by preventing a Moel from acting as such. Meaning, you're right, but you can't do that, right? You're right, you're not allowed to, we agree with your halachic analysis, but you can't make somebody else lose their parnas over it. Right, you don't have that authority. Unfortunately, in this day and age, you don't have that authority. If the Israelites of any city are willing to have the functions of a moel exercised by a man pronounced unfit for good and sufficient reasons, it is a fact, however painful and deplorable, that there exists no acknowledged authority to restrain their liberty of action. Outside of his own synagogue, a chazan or a rabbi in America is invested with no power whatever beyond expounding the law. Meaning, just give a shear and we'll decide what to do. Right? That's what they basically said to Rabbi Elohi.
But the father was Jewish and the mother was
what? What?
Would that be a Dina de Malchusa or not even?
Unclear. And he makes mention of the liberty of act, but I'm not really sure if that's what they mean. When you're a private institution, you're allowed to do whatever you want.
No, but the question is, were they, you said you don't really know the background of the paper, mm-hmm. but if it was a really Jewish paper, it could be that that's what they were.
I don't know. I don't know. Editorial mark. This is a later version. We have heretofore called attention to the controversy agitating our co-religionists at New Orleans on the subject of the moel who had been suspended from duty by Dr. Elohi, the rabbi of the congregation. It appears that the doctor had been called upon to retract his position. They said, Rabbi Elohi, take it back. Don't say that. You can't say that. Right? And a communication had been made to him by the officers of the congregation with which Mr. Goldenberg, who was the name of one of the Moalim, who he refused to take. Actually, there were three Moalim in New Orleans, believe it or not. When I was in Kansas, we had no Moalim. In New Orleans in 1860s, they had three Moalim. And two of them agreed. They said, well, we won't do it anymore. But one of them, Mr. Goldenberg, said, no, I can do whatever I want. You don't tell me what to do. Mr. Goldenberg demanding a withdrawal of his censure. Dr. Elohi requests us to publish the following reply, which he transmitted by Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. Right? So he passed it through some heavy hitters of Frankfurt and other higher authorities. We have already stated our conviction that the doctor's course was dictated by an earnest purpose of serving Israel and perpetuating the purity of the rite of circumcision and was in accordance with correct precedent. Talked about political statement there. They didn't say he's allowed to do it, but they said that he was acting in earnest, you know, purpose. He was doing the right thing. But, as we said before, he's not allowed to do that. Yeah, Michael.
Does this mean that he was
at that time to I don't know. Yeah, and that's one of the considerations that Rabbi Elohi is trying to discern. What's going to happen in the future when people say, oh yeah, I had a bris in New Orleans. Okay, well, once that's, yeah. Right. Okay. To the gentlemen of the committee from the congregation Shaarei Tzvila in New Orleans. I don't know, I think Shari Tefila, I don't know. I don't know why it's called Shari Tefila. If it was also called Shari Chesed, there might have been a split or something, I don't know. Gentlemen, I hereby most respectfully acknowledge the receipt of your favor dated the 28th of December, in which you request me by order of your congregation to recall what I have publicly pronounced against Mr. Goldenberg, a member of our congregation. Right? We're not talking about like thousands of people. You picked out Mr. Goldenberg. You know, we're talking about a few dozen families, and the one guy you're picking on, everybody knows. Believe me, gentlemen, and the Almighty who seeth into man's heart, he alone knows it, that I never felt the least animosity against the person of Mr. Goldenberg, and would my conscience tell me that I have done him wrong, I would not hesitate a moment to ask his forgiveness and revoke my declaration. But since I am perfectly convinced that I have acted fully in accordance with our sacred code, I regret my not being able to comply with your desire. Meaning, sorry, not sorry. Right? You know, I'm not taking it back. I think I'm right. Now, it should be noted, and this will take us on a bit of a tangent. He says, I further beg leave, gentlemen, to state before you the case in true shape, that you may be better able to judge whether that what I have done was inconsistency with duty, law, and justice or not. Right? So then he's going to lay out the case. Interestingly enough, before he sends this letter, this case has actually been brought, and he's going to reference it in a couple of ways, to a German publication called The Israelite. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it in German. But The Israelite, so this comes up, and a bunch of different rabbis respond to the issue at hand. Most notably, in favor of Rabbi Eloy's decision, is Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer is sort of the partner in crime of modern Orthodoxy. I wouldn't call it crime necessarily, but he and Rabbi Hirsch are considered sort of the fathers of modern Orthodoxy, at least the theology of it. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer in Germany is on Rabbi Eloy's side, but Rabbi Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, anyone familiar with Zvi Hirsch Kalischer? You know that name. What? The Drisha Sion. He writes in 1860 a very popular work called Drisha Sion, which lays out the groundwork for the first Zionist movement. He didn't necessarily see it come to fruition in his day, but it was definitely the roots of what becomes the Zionist religious movement, which goes into the end of the 19th century and early 20th century. He takes opposition with Rabbi Eloy's statement. Now, what's interesting, there are a few things interesting about this. First of all, is that Rav Kalischer is actually writing his own opinion. He writes his own opinion, not in the Israelite, because he says, people have already spoken about it. I don't want to beat a dead horse. But I'm going to write to you, Rabbi Hildesheimer. And Rabbi Hildesheimer takes Rav Kalischer's tshuva, prints it in his own tshuva, Shalos tshuvas of Rav Azriel, and I don't know if he personally did it, maybe some of his son or student, whatever, puts it in the actual tshuva, and Rav Hildesheimer actually has in the tshuva, he puts little footnotes, like little numbers, next to each of Rabbi Kalischer's points, and then in his own tshuva, goes through each of the points. I personally have never seen it before, but it might have been a Rabbi Hildesheimer strategy. And he takes each point on individually, which is very helpful for someone who's trying to figure out what the rabbi is responding to the other rabbi. Because oftentimes you get a question in a tshuva, and some points aren't addressed, some points are addressed too much, and you really wanted to hear more about the different aspects of it. So Rabbi Hildesheimer takes point by point a response to Rabbi Kalischer. And what's interesting is Rabbi Kalischer was born in 1795, and Rabbi Hildesheimer was born in 1820. So at the time of the tshuva, Rav Hildesheimer was 44 years old, you know, established Rav already, but Rav Kalischer was already almost 70. And he's asking this young buck, 44-year-old rabbi in Germany, what he thinks about this situation. Presumably, Rav Hildesheimer had a little more, even though Rav Kalischer's Drisha Sion already came out and was becoming very popular, was translated into many languages, nonetheless, he was going to Rav Hildesheimer, who had more, influence in the general community, to ask his opinion. And Rav Hildesheimer, he already knew Rav Hildesheimer's opinion based on the Israelite, but he asks, what do you think about my points? And he brings up a bunch of different points throughout the tshuva. which get a little technical and a little too time-consuming. But the response of Hildesheimer includes many of the same arguments that Rabbi Elo is going to say here. So let's move into his actual response. It is very true. And you can understand this. I said last week that it's not going to be as halachic as this week's not going to be as halachic as last week. But there is plenty of halachic material on this issue. And I can give you the tshuvas, which are very interesting, about, you know, 8 pages long. Of different arguments back and forth. But there is a big hashkafic component to this. Not just halachic, but hashkafic. On the one hand, in a general sense, Rav Kalischer is saying, how can we cut these people off from Judaism? You know, you're basically saying you're not giving them a circumcision. That means they're not going to be Jewish ever. At least you give them circumcision, you give them a shot. Their father's Jewish. Maybe they're going to turn it around. Right? This is Rav Kalischer's argument. So let's look into... And he brings a bunch of sources that non-Jews can get circumcised and things like that. But let's look into Rabbi Elohi for a second. It is very true. As everyone who is but slightly acquainted with the Hebrew language, without being a theological scholar, can read in Hilchas Gerim that the male child of a non-Israelite mother can be admitted to Judaism and brought into the covenant of Abraham. And there is no need to hear first the opinion of European rabbis about it. Right? This is a reference to the fact that it was a big stink in the Israelite. Every layman will know how to decide this question. It is, however, not to be overlooked that the admission of a child into Judaism is subject, like that of an adult, to the condition that the Beis Din must first be at least apparently convinced that there is no other motive that impels the proselyte to embrace Judaism than true and sincere conversion. Point number one, if you're going to be performing a conversion, you have to know the person wants to be Jewish. Pretty simple. Now, we're dealing here with a baby. So it's not the same case. Rav Hildesheimer makes the case that all the proofs that everyone brings for a non-Jew coming to convert are not sufficient in this case because we're not talking about a non-Jew who wants to convert, who has a mind and seichel and has to make those decisions by his own free will. We're talking about a father who is forcing his child to have circumcision even though his mother is not Jewish. Yeah. Even that child has to become Jewish. Yeah, even that child would have to go through a conversion, though.
I don't know.
It probably depends on the situation. They might. That happens when you convert together. He's talking about an adoption situation. I'm not sure how that works. Yeah, Larry. The wife is not even interested in Judaism. She could care less. Or she couldn't care less. Yeah.
There might even be when an adopted child has a present son when they turn 13, yeah. They have to accept it, but there might even be a requirement of the toughest time.
Yeah, there could be more circumcision required. Yeah.
Today there are at least some models who, in cases of
doubt,
right.
Okay, so there might be some more nuanced versions of how to go about the situation. So here, I have further to remark that, though the law permits the proper authority to admit a non-Israelite to Judaism, it is still not more than a permission granted by the law. By no means, however, can it be regarded as a mitzvah. Rav Kalischer says, not only is it allowed, but it's a mitzvah to circumcise the children. So he's responding to that claim. A religious duty enjoined on us, because experience has shown that in all ages proselytes have done Judaism more harm than good. As Rabbi Chelbo says, Yevamos 109, this is an interesting interpretation of this Gemara, which is not the mainstream interpretation. Kashim gerim l'siyol k'sapachas, proselytes are as hurtful to Judaism as leprosy to the body. Rashi explains this passage with the following words, She'Yisrael lomd m'ma'aseyam. Also unclear what exactly that means, because many understand this Gemara to be a praise of converts who keep such a level of religiosity that it mandates everybody else who has always been religious to encourage them to keep the religiosity, because at least even the people that used to be non-Jews are doing it. How much more so should you be doing it? So it is open to interpretation. Rabbi Elohi uses it in the negative in this situation. In another place, and by the way, Rabbi Elohi dealt with a lot of conversions. And he was in favor of conversion, as you saw in the last tshuva. He was in favor of someone who people were doubting their conversion. So it's, when he says all these words, he's not saying, chas v'shalom, that he's against conversion. But he says it requires a healthy dose of skepticism when it's come to this kind of situation. In another place, we read, Hagerim ma'akvim Mashiach, the proselytes prevent the coming of Mashiach. Same Gemara. Rabbi Isaac said, misfortune after misfortune shall befall those who admit non-Israelites into Judaism. Ra achar ra tavo al mekabli gerim, to which Tosfos remarks, though it seems to be a mitzvah to make proselytes, for if otherwise Yehoshua would not have made Rachav a Jewess, and likewise would Hillel not have compelled with desire of the two heathens to be made by heathen Israelites, still, these are quite different cases. Yehoshua knew from the character of Rachav, and so knew Hillel from the character of the two heathens, that they will one day become strict and faithful Jews. Yodea haya Hillel shesof and leos gerim gemurim. Meaning, you have to know the person before you consider it a good thing to do. After these remarks, allow me to add that we are, to our deepest regret, sufficiently convinced, and this is his really, Rabbi Elohi spent his life basically, many ways, criticizing what was going on in America, religiously and rabbinically. And he says, we are sufficiently convinced that all of these non-Israelite mothers in this city who consented that their children be entered into the covenant of circumcision, there is not one that has done so from a pure motive, to see her child worship one day the one only God of Israel, a religion which she herself denies in word and deed. But they did so to please the Jewish grandparents or their Jewish husbands. Whew, what a heavy accusation. Who themselves have no other motive than the children be entitled in case of death to a piece of ground in a Jewish burial place. I mean, not only do the non-Jewish mothers have zero interest in Judaism, but the fathers also have zero interest in Judaism. They just want a burial plot. They want to have a special place in the community cemetery. What? How exactly it would end up, I don't know. So part of the I don't know if he's going to say this in English part, but part of the argument that some of the rabbis were saying is that later on in history, people aren't going to know if they're not Jewish or not. They could claim that they're Jewish. Hey, look, I have a circumcision like a Jew usually gets. There are differentiations of circumcisions, although that sounds weird. I've spoken to many Moalim, and they've told me you can tell the differences. Either way, they would, however, not allow the tefillah to be applied to them, meaning, in order to convert, you don't only need a circumcision. You also have to go to the mikvah, right? So the question becomes, oh, well, are they interested in the mikvah? They would, however, not allow the tefillah to be applied to them, though I explained to some of them clearly that without the tefillah, a child of a non-Israelite mother can by law never be regarded as a Jew, though it be circumcised. It was nevertheless refused because they don't want to have their children baptized as Jews. They consent sooner to have them circumcised than to be nitval, baptized as Jews, for in their religion, the baptism is the principal and most important act. So, not really sure how that's going to play out in other circles, but yeah. So yeah, this gets into a complicated sugya, because we're not talking about a non-Jew who's an adult who has to commit themselves to mitzvah. We're talking about what's called a ger katan, a child who doesn't have the wherewithal to make these decisions. So the question becomes, are we allowed, by dint of the fact that Judaism is a benefit and it's advantageous, are we allowed to therefore say, this child, it's good for you to be Jewish? And this is what the Gemara says, that in a normal case, we can say that. But this is not a normal case. So the question is, do we apply that concept here? Yeah, Mike. Yeah, so you get a beis din together. You would have to see the tefillah by a beis. You have to see a meal by a beis din also. But what seems to be going on, although Rabbi Lowe is not saying it is in as explicit terms, is that these people want to look like they're Jewish later on for purposes of other things. That's what it sounds like. That's what it sounds like. Yeah, Bob. Right. They're not trying to convert. They're just trying to look like they're converted. Right. That's definitely true too. Meaning, even nowadays, if for whatever reason the parents want to circumcise and to do tefillah for their child, that child has to grow up and evidently show that they're interested in Judaism. What would happen in this situation if they did convert him like they would a normal child? He's going to grow up in a non-Jewish home, and he's ultimately not going to be considered a convert anyway. But no one else knows that, right? So that's part of the complication. Now let us see what are the consequences of the circumcision of these children. Of whom there are in our city about 12 of different ages, from 5 months up to 12 years, to whom tefillah was never applied. Meaning there are people in our own community that are exactly in this situation, who I do not consider Jewish. What's going to happen? They will pass as Jews and marry daughters of Israel, because they are circumcised, though circumcision never made them Israelites. But more than this, what must be foreseen is that the children of these marriages will be regarded by law as mamzerim, of whom God says, Ador asiri lo yavo b'kal Hashem, using the expression mamzerim, which may sound badly in your ears. I know that sounds like a bad word, right? Of whom God, in your ears. I must refer to the Talmud Yevamos, page Memvav, where we read as follows: Rabbi Chia came to the city of Gavla, where he saw several daughters of Israel married to proselytes who were circumcised but had no tefillah. And when Rabbi Yochanan heard of it, he said to him, Rabbi Chia, go and call out in the synagogue that the children of these people are mamzerim, who are forbidden to come into the congregation of the Lord. Meaning we have the obligation to make sure people know these people are not Jewish. And these people... Both. Yeah. It's interesting. I'm not really sure where he gets off saying this. Yeah. Yeah. So. That could be. The question becomes really: a mamzer is the product of an iser erva. I do not believe, Rabbi Belsky, maybe you can speak, I don't think the product of a non-Jewish relationship is considered a mamzer. It's not considered an erva. So I don't know if he's talking in a literal sense here. I'm not sure. I don't know. It doesn't sound based on the facts that he is, but I don't know the Gemara well either, although I've probably learned it before. Bacha. Nothing. Just taking it in. Was there another hand? Stuart, were you hit? Yeah.
Both.
Yeah, it's both. It's both. He's going to get to that. Right? There are three aspects to it. The circumcision itself, then Rabbi Eloi's ban, and then whether or not it's a sin for anybody to do this. I don't know why anyone cares if they're doing it anyway, if they're sinning, but either way, that's what the question was. And now allow me, gentlemen, to ask you another question. What shall one day become of such children, even if they would have both tefillah and milah? Educated by a Christian mother, an irreligious father, who publicly violates Shabbos and festivals, whose table is desecrated by all kinds of forbidden food, as is the case here, which cannot be denied. The mother goes to church, the father has neither church nor synagogue. In the parental house, the child cannot perceive even the slight tine of our religion. No other Shabbos than that of his mother, the Sunday, for the father has no day of rest at all, neither Shabbos or Sunday. Be sincere and say, would it not be much better for these poor children to let them be what their mothers are, Christians, than convert them for appearance sake into Jews, which they will never be, and enjoin upon them heavy duties, which as you yourselves know, they will never fulfill. Can there be anything more detrimental to the cause of Judaism than to make such Jews? Basically saying, we don't need any more irreligious Jews in this country. If they're not going to be Jewish, it's not our responsibility to make them into Jews, regardless of their father's wishes. And it's a very strong statement. And this is where Rabbi Kalischer takes issue, and he says, these kids could grow up in their father's home. Maybe their father will reignite his own faith by the fact that he knows his child is now at least on the path to becoming Jewish. Maybe the father's going to do tshuva. Maybe the child will do tshuva. And as Rabbi Eloi and Rabbi Hildesheim respond, who are we kidding ourselves? If the kid wants to grow up and become Jewish, he can grow up and become Jewish his own. He doesn't need to do it when he's a child, and we don't have to force him into it. There's no obligation for us to do such a thing. Mr. Goldenberg, pronounced simply the question before the different rabbis, whether the son of a non-Israelite mother can be admitted into the covenant, of course they must answer in the affirmative. Yeah, any child can be admitted into the covenant of Abraham, but that's not the question. Had Mr. Goldenberg stated all the above mentioned circumstances, then I am sure there is not a man in this world who has only a spark of justice and religious feeling in his heart who can approve the admission of such children into Judaism, for we would only educate them as enemies to our religion, which last is far more respected by true Christians than by irreligious Jews. In vain would we inflict bodily pain upon the poor creature and commit a grave offense against our holy religion, morality, justice, and humanity. I presume he knows about Rabbi Kalischer when he says this paragraph, but nonetheless, he says what he says. Rabbi Hildesheimer actually points out, in terms of the bodily pain issue, he says, he actually gets very, very harsh on the American situation, which we'll get to in a second. Right, he basically said we're going to make him, you know, sin a lot because now he's going to be Jewish. But he said something about, here he says, V'ata hosif shekol shekin hu liyeled zeh uma shekol shekin hu hasan. He's responding to a statement of Rakhal Sher. Who wrote zeh v'hika v'hacha anu chovlim tinok v'sakanta. We're putting this child in Yeshiva, af im echad mine elef. Even if it only happens one out of 1,000 children of this circumstance that they get hurt because of this circumcision, there's no reason for us to have done it. Right? This is basically that there is a what to be said for the fact that it could be a dangerous circumcision, which is unnecessary. And then he says, he continues, Rabbi Eloy, there, gentlemen, are, in short, the reasons wherefore I ordered the Moalim not to circumcise in future children of non-Israelite mothers, but Mr. Goldenberg, on account of his circumcision fees, for were it religious scruple, he would surely not go on Shabbos to auctions, and would not arrange a ball, as he did, on the eve of last Asar B'Tavis. Right? So obviously, this Mr. Goldenberg doesn't have the purest of intentions. Let's be honest here. Okay, he's clearly doing things that are not within the realm of orthodoxy, and despite his presentation as a pious Jew who just wants to help these little children, he's clearly not doing it for religious reasons, he's doing it for the money.
So he's not Shomer Shabbos.
It seems that way, he's not always Shomer Shabbos. These are difficult times. Yeah, it's difficult times, I don't know. Was not satisfied and declared in the most insulting manner that he has done so before and will in the future, in spite of reason and religion continue to do so, and it is therefore that I publicly declared him unfit for the holy office of a mohel. That I had the right to do so, gentlemen, I refer you to Choshen Mishpat Siman Dalet Sivav, which reads as follows: Yesh Rishus Lebeisin Lahachmir Alav Shelo Yamulu Esbanav Ulegarish Esbanu Beis HaSefer Ve'ishim Beis HaKnesses Ashi Kabel Hadin. That if people refuse to follow the words of the rabbis, and I think in this case you're really a mumar, so then you are allowed to disbar and to disallow a moel to be a moel, and he is within his right based on this source. He says, look at the Pesach Teshuva. I didn't look at the Pesach Teshuva, but I'm sure it has a further explanation of this. Hoping that this letter will convince you that I acted in the obedience of my duties, I remain, gentlemen, most respectfully yours, Dr. Eloy, New Orleans, December 29th, 5625, in 1864. So that's Rabbi Dr. Bernard Eloy's response, a very contentious response, given the history of New Orleans and given the rabbinic debate in Europe. Now, just to close, an interesting note about Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. There's actually an article I only found later on from David Ellenson, who grew up as an Orthodox Jew, but is unfortunately now no longer Orthodox, already from his 20s. But he's a big professor at Hebrew Union College, and he has actually a very interesting historical article on the conversation between Rav Hildesheimer and Rav Kalischer. And he says here, how did Rav Kalischer and Rav Hildesheimer see so differently this situation? I'm not going to say that this is definitely the truth, but it's a very interesting postulation from David Ellenson here. It is, of course, beyond the scope of this paper to offer a definitive explanation which would account for the surprising difference between Kalischer and his rabbinical peers. However, it may be that Kalischer, living physically in the traditional locale of Thorn and intellectually within a realm of medieval rabbinic Judaism, has no outgroup of non-observant Jews to contend with in forging his halachic response as to whether it was permissible for the Mohel to circumcise the sons of born to non-Jewish mothers and Jewish fathers. His immediate religious world was not threatened with dissolution, right? Rav Hildesheimer is facing assimilation at every turn. He's living in a place in Germany where everybody's, you know, becoming secular Jews. There are very daunting and sad numbers that come out of these major cities in terms of how many Jews are left Orthodox in Europe. So Rav Hildesheimer is responding to this. Rav Eloi is responding to this with the sensitivity of what's going on around him. Rabbi Kalischer has never seen such a thing. He's living in a monolithic Jewish Orthodox community. However, Eloi and his German colleagues living within the broader, more open atmosphere of the Western world had to confront both reform and non-observance as realities with which they had to contend daily. They lived constantly with the threat of being totally engulfed by forces they deemed inimical to and destructive of Judaism. As an embattled minority, their more stringent position in regard to this matter may well stem from their desire to protect Judaism in an environment they perceive to be hostile. Paradoxically, it seems the same social milieu which led to the creation of an acculturated Western Orthodox Jewry also contributed to greater strictness in certain matters of Jewish legal interpretation, meaning the fact that the Jews were living in America and were allowed to engage with secular society also brought with it the dangers of being too engaged and bring with it situations like this. Ironically, or not so ironically, after this tshuva, this already starts a little bit of a contention within the New Orleans community. Rabbi Eloi doesn't last much longer in New Orleans, partly because of this decision, at least according to some people I read, but mostly, as I said before, because the Civil War brings a lot of refugees and immigrants into New Orleans. Happens to be that the history of Rabbi Eloi's stance on the Civil War is of much discussion in terms of who he supported, why he supported them. Obviously, you know where that's going because of the way I said it. But the conversation is very interesting to see exactly why he supported the South in the Civil War, and what exactly that means in terms of slavery. Maybe on Memorial Day we can tackle that issue about Civil War rabbinic opinions of each side. So thank you for joining me today, and the Mirz Hashem, we should continue going through the early stages of American Jewry and what exactly the rabbis had to go through in order to preserve the traditions that we now hold dear in Detroit and across the country. Everyone should have a wonderful January 1st, and I'll see you next time.